Welcome to Journey's Fire, a weekly program for the visionary and the passionate soul on a mission. I'm Richard Brendan, professional speaker, life purpose coach, counselor, and former hospice chaplain. My purpose in life is to inspire the fire that burns within you and reawaken your heart for love, life, and work. Each week, I'll be bringing you engaging conversations with today's visionary leaders and social change artists. I believe that true fulfillment begins when we say yes to our dreams and take bold and inspired action to design the lives we are created for. Are you ready to live your best life? Well, Journey's Fire begins now. Imagine a united consciousness, an awareness of which all our minds are a part and a potential way out of the division, greed, and destruction that threaten to engulf our world. In the 20th century, we were introduced to several subdivisions of the mind: the conscious, the unconscious, subconscious, preconscious, and so on. But what we didn't know was that there was another level of consciousness, an all-encompassing, infinite dimension of shared intelligence, the one mind. This universal consciousness connects all of us through space and time. Even now, you're participating in the one mind. Dr. Larry Dossey, the author of the book One Mind, is a distinguished Texan physician, deeply rooted in the scientific world, and has become an international influence advocate of the role of the mind in health and the role of spirituality in healthcare, bringing the experience of a practicing internist and the soul of a poet to the discourse. Dr. Larry Dossey offers panoramic insight into the nature and future of medicine. An education steeped in traditional Western medicine did not prepare Dr. Dossey for patients who were blessed with miracle cures, remissions that clinical medicine couldn't explain. Almost all physicians possess a lavish list of strange happenings unexplainable by normal science, says Dr. Dossey. A tally of these events would demonstrate, I am convinced, that medical science not only has not had the last word, it has hardly had the first word on how the world works, especially when the mind is involved. Dr. Dossey is the author of 9 books and numerous articles. He's also the former executive editor of the peer-reviewed journal Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine, the most widely subscribed to journal in its field. The primary quality of all of Dr. Dossey's work is scientific legitimacy, with an insistent focus on what the data show. And as a result, his colleagues in medical schools and hospitals all over the country trust him, honor his message, and continually invite him to share his insights with them. He's lectured all over the world, including major medical schools and hospitals in the United States, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Cornell, the University of Pennsylvania, California, Washington, Texas, Florida, Minnesota, and the Mayo Clinic. The impact of Dr. Dossey's work has been remarkable. Before his book, Healing Words, was published in 1993, only 3 United States medical schools had courses devoted to exploring the role of religious practice and prayer in health. Currently, nearly 80 medical schools have instituted such courses, many of which utilize Dr. Dossey's works as textbooks. In his 1989 book, Recovering the Soul, he introduced the concept of non-local mind, mind unconfined to the brain and body, mind spread infinitely throughout space and time. And since then, non-local mind has been adopted by many leading scientists as an emerging image of consciousness. Dr. Dossey's ever-deepening explication of non-local mind provides a legitimate foundation for the merging of spirit and medicine. The ramifications of such a union are radical and call for no less than a reinvention of medicine. It's a joy to have him on today's program, and he joins us from beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico. Dr. Larry Dossey, welcome to the program.
It's just great, Richard. Glad to be with you.
It's always a joy to have you on here. I'd like to know, first of all, your book, One Mind. Why did you write that, and why is this book so important, especially in today's time?
Well, I've sort of been exasperated for at least half the 20th century about what we've done to the mind. We've sort of exploded it and taken it apart in so many pieces it's almost unrecognizable. We split the mind off into the conscious, the unconscious, the pre and the subconscious, and the superego and the id, and, you know, it seems to never end.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible to look through the other end of the telescope and see not the mind in pieces, but is in a unitary, connected way that unites all of us with our individual minds. This is a very, very old idea. You can trace this idea of the one mind back to the Akashic records and Hindu lore for 3,000 years. I think that there is urgency to take a backed-off perspective and look at the mind in this new way. I think that we are in deep trouble as a species on this earth. And I believe that this idea that we're connected and unified, not just with one another, but with all sentient life, is going to be necessary as a recognition if we're going to have a ghost of a chance of surviving. And I know this may sound very gloomy, but a lot of the experts are telling us that we're not too far away from tipping points beyond which we may not be able to persist.
Yes, yes.
So I don't view this as just a philosophical nicety to be contemplated at leisure, this idea of the one mind. I think it's necessary for our ability to avoid extinction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Larry, when you first introduced the concept of one mind in the introduction, you talk about a set of criteria that we could potentially use to demonstrate that one mind actually exists. You actually list quite a few, I think 10. You then state that none of these criteria are hypothetical, all of which have been demonstrated, documented, and verified. Can you talk a bit about some of these criteria?
Well, I just want to emphasize that these criteria, I think, give us total justification for going in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just repeat, they're not hypothetical. They can be and have been replicated and validated in actual, not just people's experience, but in laboratory experiments. I'll just focus on one because it's really dear to me because I'm an identical twin, and my twin brother and I have had what I call one-mind experiences all of our life.
Oh.
These are called in the trade telesomatic events. Telesomatic means the distant body, and it sort of gives a hint about what these things are all about. Telesomatic events involve two people who are usually emotionally bonded, and this is key. They're far apart. When something happens to one, the other person senses sometimes a direct verbal communication, but the strangest thing is that they often share physical symptoms at the same time. Now, this is this gives us an interesting dilemma because you have a choice as an individual of saying this is all crazy,
mm-hmm.
And it's fraud, as some skeptics do, or you can try to understand how this happens. There are thousands of these cases that have been reported. One I talk about in the book involves two little 4-year-old identical girls in Spain. One of them was helping her mom with chores and touched a red-hot iron, and she erupted in a huge second-degree burn, a big blister on one hand. And at the same time, many tens of miles away, the other little girl who was visiting the grandparents at the same time erupted in an identical blister on the same hand in the same pattern.
That's amazing.
Now, what do you make of that? I mean, this is something that causes people to scratch their head.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are clues to these kinds of sharings that I call them between people, not just identical twins, but almost anyone who's emotionally close with another person can often point to things like this in their own life, maybe not that dramatic, but nonetheless sharing ideas and intuitions with another person whom they're really in a loving relationship with.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
When I
mm-hmm.
say that consciousness is non-local, it's not bounded by space, there don't seem to be any limits to our consciousness. So that briefly is a snapshot of one mind.
Okay. Yeah, because you also talk about the ultimate argument for one mind being the non-locality of consciousness. Can you elaborate just a little bit more on that?
Yeah. Well, non-local mind is a term that I went out on a limb and coined in 1989 in a book called Recovering the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm unapologetic about connecting it with the soul, because it's a dead ringer for what for what we've always called the soul. And what it basically says is that our minds are not totally separate. You can't put a mind in a box or a brain and wall it off from all the other minds that are out there. In some sense, they come together to form what I call the one mind, or non-local mind. If something is non-local, it's not bounded by spatial constraints. Space just goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And so does time. There are studies now I go into in the book called presentiment studies, which show that we can know events in the future before they even happen. And I know this sounds weird to people who bump into this for the first time, but that's where the experiments, and this is where science comes in. And oddly, Richard, I think it's odd that science, which has for so long been the enemy of this sort of thing, is now producing evidence that actually validates it.
In the section where you talk about the survival of humans, you say that the problems we face are systemic and metastatic, involving the gradual degradation and deterioration of our world because of the way we choose to behave. You also talk about how, for some reason, we appear to have lost our ability for functioning with reason. Why do you think this is so?
Well, I think the main reason has to do with our biology. We're hardwired. I think we come into this world with brains and bodies that function as if we're isolated individuals. We are competitive. The goal, so evolutionary biologists tell us, is to perpetuate our genes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this sort of puts us at odds in an environment where we have to compete for food and survival.
Mm-hmm.
And so the biological odds are that we go through life feeling isolated in competition and, in a certain sense, alone, except for those members of our kinship group with whom we share our genes. So we'll go out on a limb to help them, you know, but when it comes to other people with whom we're not genetically related, you know, they're the other.
Mm-hmm.
So this is set the stage for an incredible epidemic of selfishness and greed that is threatening to destroy our life support systems on this planet. I think that unless we reverse this, then we are not looking at a happy future. So, again, just to reiterate, I think that to the extent that we can actualize and acknowledge our deep unity at the level of consciousness with other humans and with all other sentient life, this may be our best hope of getting through this.
Larry, in this book, you also talk about a great influence in your life, and that's Emerson. I, too, am a big fan of Emerson's work.
Way to go.
As a matter of fact, I heard an author once say that before the Fab Four, the Beatles, he was talking about bringing Eastern theology into the West, there was the Fab Three, and he talked about Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman. Emerson made a huge impact in this country. Even though you stepped away from Emerson a bit when you became initially entrenched in the science of the medical profession, you talk about how he still managed to influence you and stay in the back of your mind through those years. What brought him back to the forefront of your influence? Was there a pivotal moment for you?
Well, yeah, there was. I did not, after encountering Emerson at age 16, which was a rather shocking event in my life, reading about his idea of the oversoul and such things.
Oh, yeah.
I lost track of Emerson. You know, I was just drowned almost in materialism and all that goes with a modern medical education. There wasn't any room for oversouls in my medical education. But through a series of strange events, and some of them really painful, I rediscovered the idea of human connectedness at the level of consciousness, and it brought back Emerson. I mean, I rediscovered Emerson, and it was a joyous reunion getting back to Emerson and reading his ideas about transcendentalism and the oversoul, and how that one minds, because they come together, make it possible for us to know what the greats have known. There's some point in Emerson where he says, what Plato has known, any man can know. In other words, we're so configured at the level of consciousness that we can participate in the wisdom of anyone else.
Yes.
In the past and even into the future. And then there were experiments that really shook me up and actually unnerved me, showing that we can exchange information regardless of how far apart we are and share physical symptoms and so on, as I've mentioned. So Emerson just came crashing back at a certain point in my life, and I'm happy he did.
I'm thinking, see if I can remember it, one of my favorite Emerson quotes that I thought was amazing given the time he lived. What lies before us and what lies behind us are small matters compared to what lies within us. And when you bring what is within out into the world, miracles happen. I think he had a sense of what you're talking about.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, there was, as you've already mentioned, there was a little coterie of these guys there, Thoreau and Whitman and Emerson, were all cut out of the same cloth. And they were some of the first people in American culture that actually took a stand in favor of Eastern wisdom. It began to trickle in during their lifetime from the East to the West. And, you know, it's been sort of an unstoppable flood since then.
Yeah, it has. It has, and we're grateful for that. In the first chapter of your book, you open up with a very compelling story about Autry and how he saved a man in quite the heroic manner. Yeah. Can you briefly retell it here?
Happy to. I'm sure many of our listeners will remember in January 2nd, 2007, when this story hit the pages, and overnight this guy was a guest on every morning television show in the country. He was a 50-year-old black man. He was a Navy veteran and a construction worker, and he was standing on a subway platform in Midtown Manhattan one day with his two little daughters, and he noticed a young white man who was about 20 years old, who was an art student in New York, having a seizure, and this this young man fell from the platform onto the tracks. Instantly, without thinking, Autry jumped down onto the tracks and tried to pull him back onto the platform, but he couldn't do it. And he saw a train coming, and so he placed this young man alongside the rails, in between the rails, in a little about a foot deep drainage ditch, and then he covered him with his own body. And the train engineer saw what was happening, but he couldn't stop the train in time. And so by the time he got it stopped, five cars had passed over these two men. Autry was almost beheaded. His knit cap was stained with grease from the undercarriage of the train. But they survived. And, you know, he was flooded, of course, with photographers and journalists immediately. And they asked him why he did it, and he said, well, I just saw somebody who needed help. And it's just so touching. I just thought that this is one of the most modest, spectacular, heroic events I've ever seen in my life. He was featured as a guest at the State of the Union message, which took place a couple months later, or a few weeks later, I should say, in the nation's capital, and he's one of the people who really deserved it, because this guy did something in the classic heroic mode.
Yes, and we need to see more of that. It reminds me, what was it, maybe a few weeks ago, that we heard about the bus driver that noticed a woman looked like she was going to jump off a bridge, and he stopped his bus, he got out, and he sat down next to her and just talked with her until help came. I know, it's heart-rending to hear that. You want to see more of that in the world, I think. And that's really what your book is addressing. Also early in your book, I'm thinking it's chapter 2, you talk about Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger and his concepts and work centering around one mind. Can you share a bit about Erwin and why his work is so valuable?
Well, to begin with, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1933 for something that is known as the Schrodinger wave equations, on which quantum mechanics is based. I bring this out for two reasons. First of all, this is one of the smartest people in the 20th century. Nobody disputes that. Secondly, he was a fan of the one mind. He even, and I quote him at length in the book, he says the overall mind is only one. He said, I should say there is only one mind. Now, he didn't arrive at this through meditation or anything like that. He was deeply influenced by the philosophy of the Vedanta from ancient India, but he filtered that Eastern wisdom through his own experience and through physics. And he found in this idea of the one mind a corroboration in physics. So he's an important feature in this whole discussion because he's at the top of his game, and he is one of the great godfathers of 20th century physics. So quoting him is not the same as quoting, you know, somebody from the East that you've never heard of.
Right.
This is one of the towering figures of 20th century science.
That's amazing. Early in the book, Larry, you talk about one-mind experiences, and the stories, I think, are amazing. The Rogue Wave story is captivating and I think incorporates several different phenomena. Can you briefly retell the story for our listeners?
Well, this had to do with a husband and wife who one winter got tired of the winter in, I think it was Tennessee or Kentucky, and so they took a trip down to the Caribbean, and when they got there, they took a water taxi along the coast for many, many miles down to a restaurant, which was in all the tourist magazines they wanted to visit, and it was just your ideal day. The sea was glassy, it was a cloudless day and very warm and just ideal conditions. But this woman began to have this eerie feeling that they were about to experience a tragedy. She began to sort out their things, their luggage that they had carried along, and put the ship, the little boat, in ship shape, so as to weather what she did not know. The two native men who were piloting the boat, as well as her husband, thought she was just goofy and, you know, began to tease her and, you know, make fun of her. But all of a sudden, they saw this rogue wave coming, and it was several feet high. It lifted the boat totally out of the water, slammed it back down, and her description reduced it to toothpicks. She and everybody else was thrown overboard. She at that point found herself about 20 feet underwater. She heard her little daughter, who was being babysat by the grandmother back in Tennessee, calling to her, and she felt a hand lifting her up from where she was to the surface. Her husband managed also to survive. He had a gash and had to be taken to hospital to have surgery to repair it. But one of the strangest things is that they were rescued by a black man in another fishing boat who just really saved their lives. This is a complete mystery, because how this black man in his boat could have survived this wave unharmed when it just absolutely smashed them is just unheard of. I mean, nobody understands this.
Yeah.
But that's the story. I mean, this is so full of unexplained twists and turns and apparently miraculous happenings, and that it just, you know, boggles the mind, or it does mine anyway.
Well, it does mine too. I just find that amazing. I think it's so important that we hear more of these stories too.
Could I circle back on the Autry
case?
Yes,
please.
Rescued the guy from the subway near disaster. One of the key things in that for me, and the reason I began the book with, is that it has always mystified me why one person who has nothing in common with another person who's in need will risk his life to save that individual. And this is what humans do. And these people aren't trying to perpetuate their genes, you know, as the biologists tell us. They're responding to some other call or some other pull from in front, I like to say. And I think this is an expression of one-mindedness. The philosopher who I go to in this case is Arthur Schopenhauer, who was a 19th century German philosopher who really tried to tease apart why people behave like this. And he said, the reason one person rescues another in need is because at that decisive moment, there are not two people. Their minds have so totally fused that there is only one mind. So that at that moment, the rescuer is not rescuing someone else, he's rescuing himself. I love this because this echoes and with my experience in Vietnam in situations not unlike that, where I searched for a solution about why I behaved in crazy ways like that. And I think the one mind idea, in which we're connected totally and intimately with another person, helps understand those kinds of situations.
And it's the one thing we all have in common in terms of humanity, regardless of what country we live in.
Absolutely. You know, Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, said that this connectedness between human consciousness is so intimate that, in his words, it will jump cultures.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what race somebody is, you know, or what country they're from, or whether they're a Democrat or Republican. This is more fundamental than any of that sort of thing. And this is the connection that we need to actualize and understand if we're going to survive.
Larry, I'd like to read a quote from you. It's out of Chapter 4. in that book and in that chapter, you write, "Like stem cells, the one mind, the source, awaits instructions and prompting. This is why information arising from it can be highly individualized, not random. Pattern, specificity, individuality, therefore, typify the way the one mind manifests in our lives. It responds to the needs, wishes, desires, and intentions of individuals and situations. The one mind can spin out the thoughts and knowledge of a savant, a Leonardo, or an Einstein. It can grant the discovery of fire or the invention of the wheel. It can reveal the composition of the Mona Lisa, the periodic table of the elements, or the secret of heavier-than-air flights. Its generative possibilities are unlimited." I was going over that quote, and I just found it incredible because it gives deep meaning to the popular statement, "Thoughts are things."
Yes.
Do you truly believe that the generative possibilities are unlimited?
I do. I certainly do. I have collected over decades instances where this association with other people and where minds seem to come together really functions in a very specific way according to need. I guess the most fundamental example of that may be a mother who just knows that her child is in danger somewhere and sometimes rushes out, you know, and the classic example of pulling the child from the swimming pool when just before the child drowns or something like that. And I've often wondered, you know, well, how does this mother know that it's her child who is in danger instead of some other child on the other side of the earth? I mean, how is the distinction made? And I think the only thing that makes sense is, according to that principle of need that you just read. And otherwise, you know, our one-mindedness might be just a homogeneous goo or something, you know, where we just couldn't distinguish self from other or no specificity involved at all. But it is specific, and it is according to need. And another thing that plays a huge role here is love and emotional bondedness and compassion and emotional connection. You see that thread running through so many of these stories that the book is full of.
You also talk about the capacity of the one mind to warn us and send danger signals in precognitive dreams, which I find fascinating. And I like the story about the rogue wave. How does this happen, and how far into the future do you think this precognition can be?
Well, I think it can be infinite. I will hasten to say, however, that there are experiments that number in the hundreds now that have been done at Princeton University and Stanford, the research institute that actually try to determine what's called the precognitive interval. It's the time, temporal space, the time between the event happening in the future and when it's sensed in the present. And these studies show that it can range between seconds up to over a week So I'm not, I don't even know if that's the limit or not. You know, there are some experiences where people seem to know a year or so, even longer, before something happens.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with letting it extend, you know, years into advance sort of gives the skeptics an advantage, though. They say, well, if you can wait long enough, you know, anything's possible. So,
right.
But in these very precise laboratory experiments I just mentioned, these are so elegant and precise that we're on safe ground to say that we know at least that they extend from seconds up until several days, including a week or 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had any experiences with this?
Yeah, I have. Actually, my book before this one was a book on premonitions, and
yes.
In that book I talked about the very first year I was in medical practice, I had a precognitive dream about, well, it was 24 hours before this event happened, and when it happened, it was so precise, it absolutely unnerved me. I found it shocking. At that time in my life, I knew that the universe could not work like that, but there it was. And it really did shake me up, and it took me years to integrate that into a way of looking at the universe that permitted that kind of thing.
Hmm. Larry, in the next chapter, I believe it's chapter 5, you talk about the sense of being stared at, and Rupert Sheldrake's term for this type of sensing, the seventh sense. Why the term seventh sense, and rather than the sixth sense, which we've often been familiar with, what's the difference?
Well, he thinks this is a different kind of sense that and is so common that it just deserves a category all its own.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be willing to go along with that, but I would say that, you know, if you want to unite this with phenomena that we call telepathy and clairvoyance, I don't think it makes much difference. But the point is that we can know when somebody's focused on us at a distance, even when we're separated by closed-circuit television.
Hmm.
That's way that this is tested in the laboratory. And the odds against a chance explanation for these remote staring experiments, as he calls them, is you know, hundreds of thousands to one. This seems to be a sense that is absolutely fundamental. I came onto this, if I may say so,
mm-hmm.
when I was a battalion surgeon in Vietnam in 1968-69. I knew many young men who told me that the only reason they were alive is because they had some sense that something was about to happen, that a sniper was drawing a bead on them or something of this sort. And so I was fascinated by this because they said, first of all, Doc, it doesn't take very long. Sometimes only a second or two will keep you alive. And I thought, well, you know, one reason maybe that people are able to do this is because this conveys a survival advantage. I mean, if you can sense danger even a second or two ahead of time, it might help you stay alive and perpetuate your genes and
mm-hmm.
and all of that line of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think this idea that we can know when people are staring at us or anticipate danger even just a little bit in the future is so fundamental and so survival-oriented, it's probably widespread
mm-hmm.
The human population now. I think it's extremely common.
Has there been any studies done with our vets from Iraq and the Afghanistan war?
I don't know of any systematic study that
mm-hmm.
has gone on. It would be a great thing to do. But a lot of these young men and women come back with stories to tell
that
are in the same category.
Mm-hmm.
And what's even more fascinating to me is that you can do these kinds of studies in animals, and you can see that they have an ability to anticipate danger as well. These are pretty complex things in birds and other types of animals, but so this is not just a human faculty.
Yeah, yeah. You also talk about something that I found a little creepy, and that's people actually sense being stared at by someone viewing from closed-circuit television.
Right. There are dozens of these kinds of experiments that are on the books by now. That's right. you know, now we're really sensitive to this with the NSA.
Oh, my goodness.
Surveillance.
Yes.
So I hadn't thought of that connection.
Oh, before, and everyone can buy drone kits now in this country. It's insane.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I don't know where this is going to take us. you know, I would like to see more studies looking at the ability of people to know when they're being surveilled. And so, you know, stay tuned. Who knows where this national debate is going to take us?
Well, yeah, I know. In Chapter 7, you talk about the one mind as it applies to animals and humans. You say that there's evidence that shows that the connection is not tied to species. You've kind of addressed that a little bit. Can you share more about that? Because I, as an animal lover, an animal rights lover, I find that fascinating.
Well, there are several angles we could talk about. For one thing, there seems to be a group mind in a large variety of animals. I talk in the book about gigantic herds of buffalo and caribou who seem to turn on a dime in ways that there's not a clear way to know how through sight, hearing, or smell, or anything like that. Mm-hmm. The animal on one side of the herd could behave simultaneously with the animal at the other end of the herd. But yet they do. And this has been looked at with high-speed photography by ethologists who study this phenomenon. And it isn't just in animals. You can see the same sort of thing going on in huge schools of certain types of fish when they seem to all respond instantly.
Yeah,
that's a pretty famous one. And also flocks of birds, such as starlings, turn on a dime, you know. In the book, I give some references to videos where people can actually watch these things as they were photographed or videoed, and it's a fascinating idea.
It is. It really is.
Whose name has come up has videoed dogs who seem to know when their animals, when their owners are returning. And in his experiments, he's tried to fake out the dogs by the owner coming home at different times and through different conveyances, and you can't fake out the dogs.
I can never fake out my dog, that's for sure. I love the stories you share in this chapter. Can you share the one about, speaking of dogs, Bobby the Collie?
Well, Bobby the Collie got famous a few years back when his owners were moving from Indiana to Oregon, and the owners had made the trip before, so they knew the way, but Bobby had not. But when they were just left Indiana, Bobby, at a stop, got lost. And they could not find this dog, and they were heartbroken, but they felt that they had to keep on with their trip. And so they're settled in Oregon, and 6 months later, you know, here's Bobby bounding up the stairs, came in through a side door and jumped in the bed with the owner. And, you know, this is not a look-alike dog. He had several identifying marks and scars. And so there's been research looking at what are called returning animal events. And, you know, there are dozens of these things now that are reported in the literature. I think, you know, to get back to our theme, that this is evidence that this idea of connected consciousness and unitary mind crosses species and is not just a human deal.
I think that's fascinating. I want to quote you again later on in the book, and you say, "The main objection to the one mind is the ingrained belief that consciousness is somehow produced by the brain and is therefore confined to it." Can you talk about the evidence supporting this and why we believe it to be so?
Well, I'll just state flatly that I don't think there's a shred of evidence that consciousness is made by the brain, like the liver makes bile or something like that. This has been an idea that has been ingrained in our culture, and we become hypnotically inclined to just nod when, you know, some smart scientist gets up and says this. We just say, well, he's smarter than I am. He must be right.
Yeah,
they're not right. In my judgment, they cannot account for the behavior of distant knowing and distant sharing of symptoms and the sort of thing that we've been talking about. they have to deny all of that because they're dedicated to keeping consciousness limited to the cranium, inside the brain and to the present moment. And so it puts science in a terribly awkward position because you can't account for your observations if you go in that direction. And this is just a huge issue in science now. I go into exploring the opinions of top-rate scientists who take a different view. And the view which I think is most persuasive, which many of them have already adopted, is this. The relationship between consciousness and the brain is sort of like a television set and its signal. You know, nobody is going to say that the television set actually makes David Letterman. We know that David Letterman exists as a signal that works through the television set, but isn't made by it. And in the same way, we can say that thoughts and emotions and feelings and so on may work through the brain, but aren't produced by the brain. This is a way of looking at this relationship between mind and brain that has been adopted by William James, the father of American psychology.
Yes.
Aldous Huxley was a huge endorser of this way of looking at it, and so is Sheldrake, Rupert Sheldrake, by the way. So this is a ferocious debate. Most of those scientists who say mind equals brain really get their backs up when confronted with examples like you and I have been talking about, Richard. And the reason they do is that if they let one of these things be true, the whole game is over for them.
Right.
Right? Because, you know, their whole edifice of how to explain this just crashes.
That's probably true even in medicine, isn't it, with holistic health continuing to grow and advance?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the flap over holistic health is sort of a template against which you can understand some of these other horrible arguments that rage now about the nature of consciousness and its connection or the lack of connection with the brain.
Yeah.
But we're going to win this war, Richard. You know, and it is kind of a war. I hope you'll forgive me the military metaphor, but there's a real struggle going on, you know, and it's really bitter. But the reason we're going to win this war and is because we have the evidence on our side. We can account for these distant one-mind type of happenings, and the other side just simply cannot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We talk a lot about near-death experiences, but in Chapter 10, you also talk about shared death experiences. Can you explain what these are, Larry?
Well, you know, 15 million people are estimated by now to have had what Raymond Moody originally called back in the 70s near-death experiences, where, you know, people are on the brink, and they don't die. They're resuscitated, they're brought back, and they have a story to tell. And the story almost always revolves around a sense of compassion and intense love and acceptance and a sense of strong connectedness with everything. And this is transformational. After people pass through this eye of the needle, you know, there's no going back. Their lives are changed forever after. I call that a one-mind experience. Now, the shared death experience comes when, for example, people are at the bedside of a loved one who is dying and who may be having one of these near-death experiences, and somehow, no one knows how this works, but the loved ones at the bedside share the near-death experience. They have a sense of overwhelming peace, unity with everything, and they, too, are transformed in the same way that the near-death survivor is. This is the shared death experience. I've talked to Raymond Moody, who writes about this, and Raymond says that he thinks now these shared death experiences are just as common or even more common than the near-death experiences. They're just new to us, and we haven't got used to them and don't know how to look for them, and so, you know, most people don't go around talking about these things after they've had one.
Yeah.
So we underestimate their frequency. But I think that's something, Richard, to keep our eye on in the future, as we see more evidence and more discussion about these so-called shared death experiences.
Yeah, and Larry, that sounds like that could be another book down the road.
It could good.
What about reincarnation and communication with the deceased? Can the one mind be a vehicle for communication between the living and the dead?
Well, I think there's nothing to prohibit that. Mm-hmm. You know, once we've gone out and said that consciousness is outside of the brain and can't be walled off and confined to the present, there's nothing to prevent people from talking to the deceased. I think that this goes on all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a growth industry now of people who claim that they can mediate this, so-called psychics who can bridge between worlds. I don't think we need the psychics generally. I mean, I think this is everybody's birthright.
Oh, yes.
And yes, I think that one mind is, the idea of the one mind is absolutely cordial to communicating with people who have passed.
Mm. I read where you received the prestigious Visionary Award.
Well, yeah, it had to do with contributions to the field of complementary and holistic medicine.
Yeah.
They didn't give it to me because I can, you know, envision other worlds or anything like that.
No, I understand, but I have to say that your book, I think it was maybe your second book that you published in the early 90s, Healing Words, really changed my life. At the time, I was a minister and a counselor, and you know, those are some of the new books that were coming out at the time that helped us look at things in a different way. And now I realize that more and more med schools are beginning to change and get with the program a little bit, and even some of your books have become textbooks for some of these new docs coming out.
Well, that happens to be true. You know, I'm one of those people who's been fortunate enough to see their work make a difference and be accepted in top level reaches of my profession. I'm deeply grateful to have been able to see that. When that book Healing Words was published in 1993, there were only three medical schools in the entire country that had anything to do with looking at spirituality and healing and prayer and mm-hmm. health outcomes. And now over 90 of the medical schools have, you know, this sort of coursework where they explore these things. So mm-hmm. we're making progress, Richard. I'm happy that we are. I mean, I just think that our future depends on it.
And I don't want to put you on the spot, but what are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act? And at least the intention of trying to get everybody have access to health care.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. The Affordable Health Care Act is great as far as it goes.
Yeah,
it wasn't my first choice. Mm-hmm. I wanted universal health care for everyone.
Yes, me too.
And I think that it is a human mm-hmm. right that's been affirmed by the United Nations. We're the only rich country on the face of the earth that has not fully adopted that way of approaching it in some form or another, and I think it's a national embarrassment and a national shame. So I hope that, you know, once the line has been crossed and we have gotten off of ground zero, we can go ahead and push this in the direction that I think it needs to go, which is universal health care for everybody.
Yeah. And finally, Larry, they say behind every great man is a greater woman. You share your website with that woman, Dossie.com. I've always remembered your website because of that. And
her name is Barbara.
Yes.
She's a cardiovascular nurse. She's quite well known in American nursing circles and is the author of 24 books on spirituality and holistic nursing. And so she does in nursing what I do in medicine, and we've made a team here for 45 years.
Wow, the power couple in spirituality. I love it. I'm so grateful that you shared your time with today. I'm excited about this new book. I've enjoyed all of them. And thank you so much, Larry, for continuing to shine your light in the world.
You too, Richard. Thanks for making a difference.
Yeah, that's today's program. I want to thank you for joining me, and I encourage you to visit Larry Dossie at Dossie.com. So for engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire, inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.